nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
And it's my privilege to introduce our speaker today, Professor Sir John Henry, who will be telling us a very fascinating story about transformation of optics. And I also should mention that this is a very special series of lectures. It's called Discovery Park series of lectures. And we, in fact, the rule of the game here that you either have to be a Nobel Prize winner, and we already had a couple of those, or you're expected to become one. So I believe the latter should be the case here. And of course, Professor Sir John Henry distinguished himself actually in several areas of physics. That includes, for example, surface physics and propagation, transport in random media, extremely challenging area involving this under-solid cremation things. And most lately, he did a marvelous job and actually created this field, this what we call now metamaterials and transformation optics. Of course, for his outstanding research, he has a number of very distinguished awards, including the Descartes Prize and Award. Is a fellow of the Royal Society. He has the Royal Medal of the Royal Society of London. And I guess without much ado, let me just invite Professor Sir John Henry, and please join me in greeting him and thanking him for this lecture.
Well, thank you very much, Vlad, for that. I'll switch my microphone on, then you can hear me. Thank you very much, Vlad, for that very kind introduction. It's my first visit to Purdue, and a very enjoyable one, I must say. So thank you on two counts. I want to talk about some new ideas in optics. Actually, many people here will be very familiar with them because Vlad and his team have made Purdue a major center for research into this area. So the experts in the audience, please forgive me if I sometimes tell you things which are rather obvious to you. Perhaps the rest of the audience may need to be told them a second time. It turns out that in optics, as in most areas of study, if you want actually to do something, you've got to realize your ambitions by finding a suitable material. You want to build a bridge, you've got to use the right steel and concrete. If you want to build a lens, you've got to find very perfectly transparent material. But it turns out that in optics, many of the things you might want to do are very limited because the sorts of material properties available to you are rather restricted. But recently, a new concept has come into field of optical materials, that is metamaterials, and the idea there is very simple, that you normally when you want to change the properties of an optical material, you change the chemical composition. You add a bit of lead to glass to make the glass sparkling so you can make a fine wine glass. But there's something else you can do, and that is you can alter the microstructure inside an existing material and so alter the material properties in this way. At its very simplest, it might be drilling very, very tiny holes, so tiny you can't see the individual holes, but by lowering the density of, say, glass, you could alter its refractive index. You could make more complicated structures, tiny little metallic coils and so on. In fact, because you're altering the structure and not the chemistry, chemistry is limited by the number of elements, the structures are almost infinite in their variety that you can produce. And this adding of structure to chemistry has made accessible optical materials that never were available to us before. And given this richness of choice, we then have another problem. How do we exploit it? So traditionally, lenses and optical systems have been designed by ray tracing. So essentially, that's a job of designing a series of interfaces between fixed properties. So you have a design algorithm for the surface of a lens, for example, and you trace rays and so on. But with the things we want to do today, that's not enough. You may want to grade the refractive index of the material using metamaterials. You may want to make something which is much smaller than the wavelength of light, and the ray approximation doesn't work. So we need a new design algorithm, and we have one. And that's really what I want to concentrate on today, to talk to you about a new design algorithm for the new optics exploiting metamaterials. That algorithm has the name Transformation Optics, and why it has that particular name will become apparent as I talk. So this is the old optics, works in the ray approximation, which is valid only if all the dimensions are much greater than the wavelength of light. And it's really about refraction at discrete interfaces, so constant refraction in here, constant refraction out there, and you only change direction at the interface. And we have available to us limited material properties, which really means that you can use very simplistic design concepts. But the new vision is we want to go beyond this ray approximation. A lot of interest in this university and elsewhere in nanostructures. And on the nanoscale, light behaves quite differently from the way it behaves in your camera. In fact, it involves something called the near field, where the electric and magnetic components of the electromagnetic field begin to take on an independent existence, and Maxwell's equations are needed to take account of that. So this is sub-wavelength optics, and that's when the near fields become important. And to make a reality our expression of control, we want to exploit metamaterials. So all those are elements in the story. It's an old story, of course, because the laws of refraction, as we've been using them for hundreds of years, were first formulated by this man, Snell. We call this Snell's law. Actually, if you're French, you don't. You call it Descartes' law. Of course, Descartes actually thought about it about the same time as Snell did. I guess he got his phys rev letter in first, so that's why we call it Snell's law in the West. And also, other distinguished people have been involved in the refraction of light. Galileo didn't invent the lens, which is even older than Galileo. It goes back thousands of years. And by the way, I wonder how many of you know why a lens is called a lens. This is a bean called a lentil, which is staple food in the Middle East. And you can see that its shape is lenticular, the same shape as a lens. And that's why where we get the name lens from this little bean, the lentil. What Galileo did was to make lenses much more perfect than they'd ever been before. He advanced the technology. And he made telescopes so good that you can actually resolve the moons of Jupiter, which he named after his patrons, the Medici. He also got himself in a lot of trouble with his telescope and was imprisoned by the Pope for a time. I don't need to tell you who this man is. He is the icon of science in the 20th century. And what really made him famous was this experiment, which has to do with light. He had a theory of gravitation, which was quite different from the Newtonian picture. Isaac Newton had a picture of gravitational forces which acted at a distance. So the planets move around the sun because the sun pulls them towards it. But there were contradictions between Newton's theory of mechanics and James Clerk Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic radiation. And when you ask what happened when an electric field tried to accelerate a massive charged particle, you got the wrong answer if you use Newton's law. The error was not a big one, but it was there and led to inconsistencies. And Einstein resolved that inconsistency with his two theories of general relativity. The special one, which talked about bodies in uniform motion, and the general one, which spoke about accelerating bodies. And his theory in particular described gravity in quite different terms from what Newton did. So in Einstein's theory, space had a structure. And this was already presaged in Maxwell's equations, because before Maxwell, people knew about waves. They knew about waves in water. They knew about sound waves. But in those days, before Maxwell, when you thought about waves, it was always a wave in something. So if I send a sound wave to you, it's carried by the air, the medium. But if I flash a torch at you, I won't flash the laser pointer at you, that's not good. But if I did, the light would not be carried to you in any medium. It will be carried in the vacuum. And so Maxwell's was the first theory of waves, of sort of wave, that was waving about, nothing at all. And this caused a lot of controversy at the time. People invented a theory of something called the luminiferous ether. I won't be able to say that after two glasses of wine. Luminiferous ether, the medium which was supposed to carry the light. And people argued what was the velocity of this medium? When could we be measured as moving relative to it? And Einstein said, well, no, the velocity of light is constant in all frames of reference, so you can't think of a medium, imaginary or otherwise, which is fixed, through which the light is moving. And when he moved on to his general relativity theory, he thought of space having a structure, just as when you send light through space, space has to have some properties, some structure, in order that the light can move through it. It is in fact moving through the geometry of space. And Einstein reckoned that the property of space which is important was its geometry. And the way a gravitational field acts in Einstein's theory is that it actually distorts the geometry of space. So it's like bending space. So imagine in two dimensions that you have a sheet, and on the surface of that sheet, light moves in straight lines. And now if I mold that sheet onto the surface of a sphere, light does something very peculiar. It moves in the shortest distance between two points, but of course the lines aren't straight anymore, and they have the curious property that they actually come back and meet themselves after a certain time. That's a very peculiar sort of curvature. So he had the theory that gravitational objects accelerate other massive objects by distorting the space around them. Now, that not only is a very, very difficult, different philosophical interpretation, it actually has physical consequences. Because if you now take light, which is a massless particle, and therefore, in Newton's theory, should experience no attraction, because Newton's law is the product of the masses divided by the distance squared, then in Einstein's theory, light is moving through space just as a massive particle is, and then therefore should be sensitive to a gravitational field. And it was this prediction that light is deviated by a gravitational field that led Einstein to predict that a position of a star should be shifted in the sky if its trajectory of light passed close by the sun. And Eddington set up this experiment in 1919. He set up two experiments to observe an eclipse, because you can only see starlight near the sun when the direct light of the sun is blocked off by an eclipse. And one of them failed because there were clouds at the time, but the other experiment succeeded, and Eddington did observe the deviation of light by the sun, and so confirmed Einstein's theory. Many people had dismissed Einstein's theory as ridiculous at that time, and so its publication was a real revolution. It was the first and only paper ever to be published on the front page of the London Times. And after that event, Einstein became not just a brilliant scientist, but the icon that we know today, a very special man. Now, I tell you all that because if you ask, what happens to the form of Maxwell's equations if you write them using Einstein's notation? Now, Einstein, as I say, described gravity as a distortion of space, and the distortion he measured by something he called the metric, G. And the metric is a very simple quantity. It describes how much you squash or stretch space in the gravitational fields that you're observing. And then if you rewrite Maxwell's equations using this mathematical quantity, the stretching of space, the metric, what you find is that this quantity, the metric, sits in Maxwell's equations exactly where the refractive index sits if you're describing a real material. And therefore, it's not really surprising that the sun deviates light. It is, in fact, a little lens with a refractive index around it. And if you have even more powerful gravitational fields, such as surround a galaxy or a black hole, then you do see this gravitational lensing, and astronomers use it all the time to calculate masses of galaxies and so on. And that's the cue to the things which we want to achieve using transformation optics, because we're going to steal Einstein's theory, and what we're going to say is that here is a beam of light going through free space, and of course it travels in a straight line, you know that. But now we imagine that it's embedded in a rubber sheet that's something you pull and distort, and we're going to mark that sheet with a coordinate system just to keep track of where all the bits and pieces are. And now we stretch that sheet, and because the beam of light is fixed to the sheet, so it moves as you stretch the sheet. You're not just moving the beam of light, you're distorting the whole space around continuously. And when you're done stretching and pulling, then you're satisfied the direction of the beam of light is going, then you end up with a distorted rubber sheet. And the distortion you can record as a distortion of the coordinate system. If you're mathematically inclined, you can call that a coordinate transformation, but it's just really a distortion of the system. Now, Einstein actually had a formula for his metric in terms of the distortion of this system here. It was just how much the system was squashed, obviously. He's recording the stretching of the system. And so, if we want to send the light in this direction, knowing how we've distorted the space to achieve that, we can go on to calculate what refractive index we must use to send the light in this direction. And that's the basis of transformation optics, with some help from Professor Einstein. However, the idea that a ray of light is nailed to the coordinate system isn't just confined to a ray of light. Any conserved quantity, and for example, the electric field or the magnetic field, both of which are conserved, behaves as though it's nailed to the coordinate system. So not only do we take rays of light, but even static electric and magnetic fields we can distort in this way. So it's a very complete theory of the distortion of fields which appear in Maxwell's equations and how to achieve it using materials. And we can achieve these these distortions because we have access to these very special materials, to the metamaterials I mentioned earlier. So David Smith and I worked on this problem some time ago, and we then asked ourselves, well, we're very excited about this. How can we tell it to a general audience? How can we convey our excitement about these ideas? Should we write down some transformations? Would partial derivatives impress? I think not. So what we decided to do was to sock people between the eyes and do something which most people would find very surprising. We decided we wanted to hide something. And we decided that if we could make something completely invisible, then that might surprise people. So both of us had had something to do with stealth technology in radar, and ordinary stealth technology is quite simple to understand, difficult to achieve, but what you do in conventional stealth is to make the object black so that it absorbs light and doesn't reflect light. By the way, this character here is Peter Pan, and maybe some of you know the story of Peter Pan. Peter Pan is the little boy who lost his shadow. And of course, that's exactly what you have to do to make Peter disappear. Not only must he not reflect light, he must lose his shadow as well. And he's a bit of a mascot for us, actually, because this is his statue in Kensington Gardens, which is just north of my college in London. So we know how to paint Peter black, but the more difficult thing is to get rid of his shadow. And when you do that, then he's gone. Can't see him. And actually, in radar technology, increasingly, people are concerned about being able to see objects which are black, but nevertheless cast a shadow. If an aeroplane flew over Chicago, for example, it would make a shadow in the mobile telephone conversations going on all the time. And if you had access to the signals from all the stations, you could tell from the shadow that an aeroplane was flying over. And of course, in submarine acoustic warfare, then it's the acoustic shadow you look for all the time, not the active signal from these machines. So, although making something invisible may sound esoteric, once you get down to the practicalities of it, viewed as a sort of mathematical thing, then it's perhaps not so difficult. So what we want to do is to stop light from entering this central region here, and in here we're going to hide something, and if the light never hits this region here, then obviously we don't see what's in there, but in order that there not be a shadow, then we want to not throw away this light, but we want to carefully usher it around here so that it comes making the same trajectory, same direction that it did before. And then anybody looking from here would just see the same ray of light that it did this case, and would see what's behind this object and not the object itself. And if you confine your distortions of space to this region here, then the straight lines will persist here. So we only need to have any special material in this surrounding region here. We put what we want in here, and this can be free space if we choose. So that's the strategy. And we're going to use metamaterials to achieve that. And it's a bit like a mirage, really. You all know how a mirage works. I'll just remind you. So traditionally, it's the thirsty traveler in the desert. In the distance is hot air, warmed by the hot desert surface. And because it's hot, it's less dense than the cool air above. And so there's a gradient in the refractive index. And if the index is graded, light no longer travels in a straight line. It follows a curve that curves upwards. And so Instead of seeing the sky up here, the sky appears to be reflected in the desert surface, and a natural interpretation of this is that there's some water there. In cooler climes, we may sometimes see a road mirage. This is the road appearing to be wet on a hot, sunny day, and that's exactly the same effect of gradient index here. And so it's this grading of the index that we're going to use to achieve that effect. And when we do that, we can guide light continuously around the object, returning it to its original trajectory. I think I've already explained metamaterials to you. Just go over that again. An ordinary material owes its properties to the atoms and molecules. It's polarized, say, an electric field. But you can also have objects in there which are bigger than an atom and molecule, still smaller than the wavelength, but which are, can actually be man-made. These might be nanostructures in the case of light, bigger structures in the case of radar waves, but they can give you a much more complicated response because they're basically more complicated entities than atoms and molecules. There are various designs employing this. Here's one from this laboratory, which Vlad and his team have been involved with, and they have proposed that by introducing short metallic wires into the dielectric host and making a structure that looks like this, so you can make the right anisotropic refractive index here that will guide light around the cylinder. And when you do this, you find that here, I think, is... Where are we? Okay, so here is a cylinder, a metal cylinder, without any cloak around it, and you see there's a big shadow here, lots of stuff scattered all around. And when you incorporate this material here, you can see that the flow of energy is being diverted around this central region, and what comes out here are lines in almost straight lines. This of course, is a practical implementation of the cloak, and therefore, it's theoretically, it should be perfect, but in practice, it's difficult to get things perfect. And I think I have another one here of Vlad's. So the idea here is that you make a waveguide from two pieces of metal, and the effective refractive index of light in a waveguide depends on how thick, how wide the waveguide is. So by grading the width of the waveguide, you can tune the refractive index, and it turns out that if you just do this classic experiment of a sphere on a flat surface, then that has many of the properties of the graded index you need to steer light around and to hide something. So there are many possible implementations of the formula for cloaking. So that was done some time ago, and what I want to tell you about now are some of the things which have happened since. The first cloaking experiments were in fact done for radar waves by David Smith and his team in Duke. But Jensen Lee, very bright young postdoc of mine who is now back in Hong Kong, suggested that you could, in fact, design a cloak that would work at optical wavelengths. It's relatively easy to make one at radar frequencies because these metamaterials are easier to make there. To make a metamaterial at optical frequencies is more difficult. And so what we chose to do was to make a simplified version of cloak, which was in the form of a tunnel which was raised over a conducting surface. And here is the way that Jensen made the cloak. So what he wants to do is to shove all the rays of light outside this region here. Here's my coordinate system, and the simplest thing you might think of doing is to raise all these coordinates and just squash them in the y direction. And that surely would deviate light around here. However, it does present very great difficulties in manufacturing this cloak, because if you notice, these little unit cells are anisotropic and they squash differently in each direction. And that means that this optical material is anisotropic. That's difficult to make. It's also birefringent. So if you make it of just one material, you find that you make a cloak only for one polarization of light and not the other. And so the trick is to squash these cells in such a way that although you change the area of each little square, it doesn't change its shape. And that's called a conformal transformation or a quasi-conformal transformation. And you can get computer programs which have lots of transformations which will create this hole, and we chose the one with the least distortion. So it's now isotropic, and you have a normal isotropic refracting material here. And here's a demonstration of what happens if you just have a conducting tunnel here made out of a metal sheet, and then you see a ray of light comes in, and each of these mirror-like surfaces produces its own reflection. So if you were scanning an optical beam over the surface, as it scanned over your little tunnel, you'd suddenly see two flickers of light instead of one reflected beam, and it would be obvious that it was there. But if you cover it with a cloak, then these two beams merge back into one, and it's as if the tunnel were not there. And Jensen actually gave parameters for making this out of silicon and silica. And in fact, that cloak was built by the Zhang team in Berkeley and published in April of this year. It was broadband and it worked not quite at optical frequencies, but these are even more important frequencies of the communications wave band used in optical fibers. And here's their design of an optical cloak. They graded the refractive index by the very simple expedient of just drilling holes, just making, just like a mirage, of making the material less dense. But you can see the density is carefully graded here by the density of holes in this material. And the light comes in here and should reflect as a single beam. Let's see if that happens. Oh, sorry. Here's an electron micrograph of the cloak. That was this was just a schematic picture, and now this is the actual cloak realized in silicon and silica. And here's the little tunnel which is being screened as the material. And now we're going to shine some light on that. This is what happens if you shine light on a mirror. You get a single beam, of course. Here's the experiment on a mirror, flat mirror. You see a single beam coming off. And now if you make a little tunnel here out of metal, a little triangle of metal here, you get several beams actually, but two from the faces, and it's obvious that there's something there. And then you put a cloak around this, and again, it just appears as though you've got a flat surface, and whatever is inside the tunnel completely disappears. So the ambition of making an optical cloak has been realized. So we were successful, too successful, if anything, in making people sit up and take notice that transformation optics was important. We and others have demonstrated that you can hide things. The mathematicians told us we couldn't when we originally made this proposal, but it turns out that they missed something from their proof, so it all was okay in the end, and you could make a cloak. But I don't want to oversell this cloaking thing, because it's not the only thing you can do with metamaterials and transformation optics. There are other things, and I want to go on to show you that there are other things that you can do with transformation optics, some of which are perhaps even more surprising than the cloak. So I gather that Victor Vesalargo has visited you here, the grand old man of negative refraction. And what Victor told us many years ago was that, as well as this kind of refraction, when light enters a material and does so on the opposite side of the normal from which it entered. This is called positive refraction. But if the light bends back on itself past the normal, then this is negative refraction. This angle is negative here, and Snell's law tells you that the refractive index is negative. And Vassilago investigated this in detail in 1968 and published all the consequences, but his vision remained unrealized until metamaterials came along and were able to make a material with a negative refractive index. But I want you to pause for a moment and ask, in the light of some of the things I told you at the beginning of the lecture, why is negative refraction so curious? Plus, minus, we can all do our sums. What's the big deal about having a minus sign there? Why is this little thing of this line crossing from the positive side to the negative side? Why is everybody making such a big deal out of it? Well, I would remind you that at the beginning, I made this analogy between Einstein's theory of space, in which he described the crushing of space by the quantity called the metric. And I told you that the metric is exactly equivalent in Maxwell's equations to a refractive index. So, if I can produce something with a refractive, effectively negative refractive index, this looks like what would happen if I took space and I turn it inside out. If I made some negative space. And Victor was very close to that interpretation because he did point out that one thing that negative refraction could do was to focus light. So if you have a negative angle here, it turns these rays of light back to the axis and makes a second focus here, and indeed a third focus out here. And actually, the interpretation of that in terms of space is in terms of some negative space. So you can imagine that what you think is happening as light goes through the lens, what you see is a light going continuously, and thinking of this central beam here going through here. But what the light thinks is happening, because we've changed the sign of space in the refractive index, is that space, as far as light is concerned, looks like that. The light hits the lens, and then it goes backwards in space. So if you have a focal point here, the focal point is passed three times. One, two, three. And so that is part of the reason why people were very surprised by this reality of a negative refractive index. And in order, you can imagine, just imagine if you could not just do it with a refractive index. Imagine if space could really be made negative. I could sneak here, round the other side of his computer, and I could be here three times as I walked around. I could also do things like reach through from the other fold in space. This is still three-dimensional space, but I could actually reach through from one part of it to the other, just as if I was sitting on that part, I could do things elsewhere, okay? And you can very soon convince yourself that if you could really do that, there'd be lots of logical paradoxes. And the way we stop the logical paradoxes happening in optics is to say, well, this only works at one very specific frequency, so for this pattern of light to be established, you have to wait for actually an infinite length of time. And the fact that you have to wait for this negative stuff to emerge means that you don't have the time to do all these illogical things you could if you imagined walking through this trajectory. So in optics, you can protect yourself like that. You can never achieve negative space for a real gravitational field. But nevertheless, the fact that you can mimic negative things means you can have some fun in optics. This lens is one example, making a lens by essentially annihilating the space next to it. Another way of thinking of this negative space is that it's, how to put it, optical antimatter. It just eliminates the piece of space next to it. So this piece of negative material has just eliminated this positive space. So this point is this point here. It's not approximately so, it is actually that point. So one way of saying that is to ask mathematically what happens if you calculate from Maxwell's equations something called the transfer matrix. The transfer matrix takes all the electric and magnetic fields in this plane here and uses Maxwell's equations to tell you what they are in this plane down here. And if you go into Maxwell's equations and you tell them that this is the situation you have with a negative refractive index here, then what turns out is that transfer matrix from here to here is exactly unity. So whatever fields you have here, you have exactly the same ones there. And so the conclusion from that is that this is a very unusual lens that Victor Vessel-Argo invented. It is perfect. Remind you that an ordinary lens, such as you have in your camera or in your DVD reader, is imperfect. It can only resolve objects which are greater than the wavelength. And that restriction in the power of a lens has been known for ever since wave theory of light was initiated. And it's very, very limiting because the wavelength of light is the order of a micron, and we want to work with nano objects today, a tenth or a hundredth the size. The lines in your computer chip are tens of nanometers across, and you can't see them with an ordinary microscope. So it's very, very limiting, and this exciting possibility that it is theoretically possible to make a lens with a resolving power better than the wavelength holds out some serious promise for the future, and I'll come back to that later. But first, I want to explore a little bit this idea of negative space. Actually, this theorem of negativity can be extended, and the theorem says that two bits of optical matter annihilate one another if the values of epsilon mu at this point are reversed at the mirror image point across this plane here. So that's obviously satisfied for this lens here, where you have plus one, minus one, so on and so forth, and therefore you eliminate the space. But David Smith said, well, if your theorem's so clever, what about this? So you see what David's done. The mirror theorem is obeyed, the conditions are obeyed here. But what about this? He's cut out a bit of negative stuff here and he's put it here in the mirror image position. So now the conditions are still satisfied. You have a plus here, but a minus here at the mirror point. And so in the ray theory of light, what should happen is that light goes straight through here, fine. This ray of light should still go straight through because the theorem says this isn't there, optically speaking. But if you apply the laws of negative refraction, they tell you that this light is rejected. What's going on? Well, the theorem was proved using Maxwell's equations, and Maxwell beats rays any time. So we have to understand why the ray theory is going wrong. And this is an illustration that we're taking optics beyond the ray theory. We're describing situations for which you have to use Maxwell's equations, and you get the wrong answer if you don't. And here's a prime example of the ray theory telling you one thing, and it's the wrong answer, because Maxwell clearly tells you different. In this case, Maxwell says this ray will go through. The ray approximation tells you it won't. To get a clue of what's happening, just imagine if the ray did get to this point here, and then it would actually refract round in a circle. Now, trapped light behaving like that is a resonance. And resonances can build up in intensity with time. Imagine a singer singing at a wine glass at the resonant frequency. Sometimes that singer can break the wine glass. So powerful is the resonance. And these rays actually are only approximation to infinitely thin lines. They do actually have little tails on them. They are at best so-called Gaussian beams with tails. And the tails can tickle the resonance and feed energy into it. And when there's enough energy here, this resonance can be very big. And in its turn, energy can leak out of the resonance into this beam here. So what happens is that when you first switch on, this system does reflect the light. Gradually, this resonance will fill, and the light will leak out here, which is the light you want. What about this ray here? Well, light has an amplitude and a phase, and the phase with which the light leaks out here cancels this intensity. So eventually, with time, this will disappear, and you'll come to the full transmitted signal here. And actually, David had saved me the misery of working that out. He'd actually done a full Maxwell simulation. So here are some waves hitting this refracting cylinder, and lots of reflective waves, everything scattered all over the place. And now you introduce the optical antimatter, and you can see that to within the accuracy of the calculation, all the scattering vanishes, except in the region of this. And perhaps you can see little red bits here in the simulation, here and there. Those are where you have these very strong resonances which are producing this cancellation effect. So we have to go beyond Maxwell, beyond the ray approximation, because the ray just get it wrong sometimes. Now, here's something else that you can do. This is Victor Vassilargo's lens. It's perfect, wonderful, but then you think, well, I might like my lens to make something bigger and still be perfect. Tough. This lens says that this is an exact copy of the object and therefore is exactly the same size. But remember transformation optics, and you can distort this system here, and you can actually make the image as big as you want, and then go and ask what is the value of the refractive index that you put in place to make that happen. So a simple mathematical transformation which will make this happen is to say that if I make this axis not the x-axis but the logarithm of a radius, so as I go out in radius I go positive, negative, positive, and if I made this direction here an angle, so that if I go round in angle the thing is cylindrically symmetric, then I get to this geometry here with an inner region which is positive, an outer region, as middle region which is negative, and an outer region here which is again positive. And a trajectory of light can be focused to a small object here, a larger object here, and a very big object in this region out here. And these guys will have different sizes, and they will also be perfect in that every detail will be reproduced. Now, again, this system is surprising. And it's surprising for the following reason, that if... Oh, I normally need a glass here. I have to use your imagination. If I took a bottle, which will have to remain invisible for reasons of its absence, if I took a bottle and I filled it full of a fluid such as milk, I don't know if you... may I use your Coke bottle? Thank you very much. Good. I don't know if you can see from the back there, but despite the fact that the plastic has a finite thickness, the coke appears to go right to the edge of the bottle. Same's true of a milk bottle where the glass is even thicker. An explanation in that case is very simple, because every ray of light that strikes the glass or the plastic actually goes through the coke or the milk, and therefore has the color or the texture of the coke or the milk. Now imagine that the bottle was not made of glass. It was made of this negative refracting material. And then something rather surprising would happen, because if the milk is in here and the lens is doing its job properly, the milk would appear to fill not merely the bottle, but this larger sphere here. So they're called super milk bottle. So if I held the milk bottle up here, it would appear that the milk was actually filling empty space. How can you do that? You need to figure out that out for a moment whilst I show one or two more slides. So so here is a refractive index that you must use, this negative refractive index that you must use to fill this space here. It's anisotropic, and it depends on the radius as well. And if you do a ray tracing argument, this shows you in detail why I think that's a paradox that the milk should be out here. So if you take these rays, if the rays go through the milk, then they'll look like milk, okay? So I'm okay out to here. These rays hit this region here, and they go through the milk. So fine. The bottle itself appears to be milk color, just like the milk on your doorstep. But what about these rays? These rays don't hit anything. Certainly don't hit the milk, and so these rays here shouldn't look like milk. However, here's a solution of Maxwell's equations which shows all these waves here being compressed into this inner region here, and therefore Maxwell's equations tell you that this red region here would appear to be full of the milk, which is actually in this much smaller region here. And for those who have epilepsy, please close their eyes. So here's an animation of that. And what you can see is that the waves, rather than the rays, because this is Maxwell's equations, are actually being captured by this negative stuff and are being compressed into this region here, demagnified, in other words. And even these waves which are out here are connected through these tubes here and do, in fact, appear. So the milk bottle, everything that hits this red circle is compressed into this inner region, and therefore the red circle would appear to be full of milk. Okay. The epileptics may open their eyes now. Thank you. And hopefully I haven't frozen my... Yeah, okay, that's good. So, how can we exploit that? It's all very fun looking at milk and putting your hand in it, but maybe you can do some useful things with this, because there are, in fact, a number of devices which work within the ray approximation, but which do not work if they're much smaller than the wavelength. One example of this is a shadow. So if you want to shade an object, you put something reflecting or black here, and then anything behind it sits in its shadow and is screened. Okay, I'm teaching my grandmother to suck eggs. But I remind you that the shadow doesn't work if the object making the shadow is smaller than the wavelength, because light then can use its wave properties to creep behind, around the sides and fill in the shadow. So if we shorter material, or we're working at very long wavelengths, and we wish to create a big shadow using a relatively small object, then we can't do it except if we use this milk bottle trick. Because here what I've done is to put, actually the guy who did this, it's not me, it's Wei Sheng Wei, my graduate student, and it was also done in Hong Kong by these guys here, independently. And what we did was to put in an absorbing material here and to surround it by this magnifying lens so that it appeared to be as big as this. This is a simulation. And then, by the way, this is empty space. There's nothing in this region here. So when you shine light on this, you now see a shadow which is much bigger than the objects creating it. And these objects, here is the wavelength, and these objects are the same order of the wavelength, and yet they're creating a shadow that is well-defined and large. Something else you can do, which is slightly more sophisticated, is you've heard of corner cubes. These are just mirrors arranged at right angles, and if light bounces off the two of the mirrors, it will have its direction reversed. And NASA puts these things on the moon so that if you shine a laser beam on the moon and it hits the corner cube, the light bounces straight back at you with strong intensity. Very useful, but they only work in the ray approximation. If the corner cube is smaller than the wavelength, it don't work. Except if you put it inside this lens system. So here I put essentially a corner cube, a back reflector, inside my magnifying lens, and now it looks as though it's much bigger than the wavelength, and it's producing this characteristic strip. So the waves are coming in this way. Here are the back reflected rays from the retro reflector. So there's some interesting things you can do. And the final thing is to show you an experimental realization of the perfect lens. One realization, approximate realization you make of it is by using a slab of silver. And this suggestion was realized by Jiang Zhang's team when he was at UCLA, he's now at UCB. And the idea is this, that you can use a slab of silver, providing it's very much less than the wavelength, as a lens. It will focus light like a Beslargo lens. So this silver has this negative property and is annihilating this piece of space next to it. And so if you have an object here, in this case a chromium mask, then the chromium mask will be directly imaged into the photoresist, and you should be able to read it when you strip away this stuff and develop the photoresist. This whole kit is much less than the wavelength. The wavelength is 365 nanometers. All these distances here are a few tens of nanometers, and the grating is a sixth of the wavelength in spacing, and you can clearly resolve this. Perhaps more impressive to the eye is the letter nano, which has been written. So here's a focused IMB image of the chromium mask. Here's what you see if you just have the spacer there, no lens. And the width of these lines is now the same order of the wavelength. You can't resolve better than that. So that's a scan across the lines here. Now you pop the lens in space, in place, and it's obviously like putting the glasses on. And the resolution pops down by a factor of the 6 to 89 nanometers. So that was the first optical demonstration. The first RF demonstration was by Eleftheriades in Toronto, that a lens is not only an elegant theoretical concept, but it's also something that you can make in the laboratory. And so with that, I hope I've conveyed to you some of the enthusiasm and fun that we're all having with this very new area of optics, and I hope that you've enjoyed my telling you about them as much as I've enjoyed telling you. Thank you very much.
Well, if there are some questions, I hope there are. Please. in the context of, say, an experiment where they see extraordinary transmission of light through soft wavelet aperture.
Yes.
And also recently, reverse has also been shown where you take the film to be very thin and light doesn't come out, whereas it was transparent.
Yes.
How should one actually understand this principle with respect to, let's say, transformation?
Actually, I'm not sure transformation optics does help a lot there. The way I think of this is that it has some things in common with what I've been telling today, in that the light which is incident on these very, very tiny holes. Maybe I should explain a little further for the audience that experiments have been done in which you make tiny holes in a silver film. Now, if Bethe did a theory of transmission through tiny holes in just an ordinary black material, and he showed that the transmission coefficient drops very, very rapidly as the hole gets smaller in the wavelength, and essentially for these holes in silver, you shouldn't see anything. Actually, I elaborate the story a little bit because I know Thomas Edison very well, who did the first experiment, and he was working on something quite different in Japan at NEC, and he ordered a silver film with a few sub-wavelength holes punched in it, and the lab took a very, very long time to make this sample. Eventually went down and said, what's going on? He said, oh, very, very difficult, sir. Very many holes. And they actually, Japanese, English, and so on, they mixed these things up. And the sample was 1,000 times bigger than he asked for it. So they drilled many, many thousands of holes. And so he said, well, you know, can use this. And then he noticed that he was seeing through this stuff. It was transparent. Okay, and it shouldn't have been. And he measured the spectrum, and he found it had a series of peaks. And the peaks explained why the transmission coefficient was so high. Because just as some of these anomalous processes I've been telling you about here are cases where the light is captured into a resonance, and then the resonance forces it through this structure that David Smith shows, so it is with these holes, that the holes are surrounded by a plasmonic resonance. If they're made in silver, the light's captured into that resonance, and then it builds up just huge pressure. So although not a very large fraction of the light goes through, the density of energy there is so great that even the little bit goes through is enough to make it very transparent. And that's the way we think of the Abelson experiment. The more recent experiment is interesting, but not quite so extraordinary as that, where you actually get zero transmission. Well, that's just the resonance where it's there's something called a Fano resonance, where you have a destructive interference, and I think that's the correct interpretation there. Sorry for the long answer.
So in thinking of more classical objects that aren't just sort of surface effects, I think of multimode fibers with graded index and graded index time.
Sure, yes.
Now, the index variations are, of course, small, and the way these were designed, I'm sure they'd use this sort of Xi algorithm that you described. But are these fundamentally similar, or what would you say are fundamentally
different? There is another restricted version of transformation optics around, in which you apply the laws of transformation not to the full Maxwell's equations, but you apply them to ray, the equations of ray optics, and using that form of transformation optics, you can design these fancy lenses which do all sorts of extraordinary things, the graded index fibers and whatnot. And actually, alongside our version of the full cloak to the level of Maxwell's equations, was simultaneously more or less published a paper by Ulf Leonhardt, in which he arrived at very similar conclusions, but within the ray approximation. So yes, rays do have a transformation optics of their own. And as a matter of fact, you can apply transformation optics to acoustics in fluids as well. Unfortunately, not to acoustics in solids, because the elastic equations are a bit of a mess when you transform them. You get all sorts of physical terms. But
Schrödinger equation as well.
And the Schrödinger equation, yes. Yes.
Other questions, comments?
I was just curious to know whether, using the same cloaking mechanism, can one actually make something visible which is not invisible? In the sense, like, let's say a molecule which is hidden somewhere behind something, because essentially the light has to actually have the property to actually get information from those places where it's not.
Oh, you mean can you communicate with what's inside the cloak? And the answer is definitely not if you use the frequency at which the cloak is designed to operate. But although cloaks can be broadband, they're never infinitely broadband. So you could always find a frequency sufficiently far away from the central cloaking frequency that you could actually get some sort of signal out there. And of course, you could always speak to the person outside the cloak.
We actually have yet another part to this event, and now I'm asking Tim Sands to do something else.
Well, it's not all that involved, but I'm Tim Sands. I'm the director of the Burke Nanotechnology Center. It's my honor on behalf of Discovery Park and Purdue University to present you with your latest milk cup.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, fantastic.
It will hide your milk, however.
Thank you.
It's a piece of handmade art made by Sharon Owens of Inspired Fire, specifically for our Discovery Lecture Series speakers.
Thank you. That's beautiful.
Discovery Lecture Series is intended to bring the latest thinking in science and technology to our Purdue faculty and students, and I think your lecture did just that. It was wonderful. Thank you very much.